So, how's it going? I missed you all. So these three ideas again that I mentioned at the start, purification, training, and realization, that I find that helpful to understand how the whole thing works, because sometimes I really don't have to meditate, I just have to stop distracting and just allow tensions or whatever to come out. So one time when I got quite burnt out with too much responsibility, what was important for me was just to get out of that framework, and then just I couldn't meditate really because my inner world was so tense. I basically just had to give myself the time to allow the tensions and emotions just to come out, and that was pretty obvious. That was purification. And there, faith and trust and some sense of humor, these things are very, very helpful. And then at times it's a time for training where you just, it's, I guess it's like sport or music where you just do your exercises. And so you pick up the breath and you just stabilize the mind because you just feel that'd be a good thing to do now. But not as a end in itself, it's just calisthenics. Buddhist calisthenics, you just do it. But if there's a lot of material coming through, and then you're trying to do the calisthenics, as it were, to kind of get rid of the material coming through, then it gets very, very confused. Or just doing the heart practice is just to, one just sometimes, yeah, let's just juice up the heart a bit, and just pump it up a bit. So you do that for a while. And the training is done when, well, it gives the strength of mind to oftentimes bear with the purification that we have to go through, and also to give stability of mind for insight to arise. So one has a kind of appreciation of just training the mind sometimes. But all the time, imagine just a whole life of just or walking slowly for the rest of your life. It's just good. Ajahn Chah's joke with a slow walkie was, what do you do if you have diarrhea? So the training is not an end in itself, but as a useful thing to do sometimes. And then one just has things that one finds help to balance and strengthen one's own character. So basically, for me, there are things to compose the mind, collect the mind, and then practices of the heart to open the heart. Those are the two things I tend to kind of come back to. For you, well, how do you train? How do you stabilize? How do you open the heart? And then the third, so that's training, and the third is realization. Just that, and that's an ongoing thing. It's not like realization is a kind of one-off affair. You sort of train and you purify, then oing. Maybe it is. But also there's a lot of little realizations on the way, aren't there? You just understand how to deal with this or deal with that or whatever it might be. So like I think vipassana, I think it's an overused word because it's actually not, you don't find it much in the Pali Canon. I asked one teacher, I said, you always talk about vipassana, I'm a Buddhist. Did the Buddha sit under a tree and do vipassana? Well, actually he didn't. He just kind of watched his mind and did breath and so on. So the vipassana has become a... I don't even know what it means anymore, because Mr. Goenka uses it differently, and I guess John Kabat-Zinn uses it differently, and IMS uses it differently, and so on. So I guess it has sort of different Burmese technique ideas in it, like slow walking and so on. But if you look at the idea of a mind which is insightful, then it seems to me a healthy mind, when it's open and attentive, allows for insight to arise, because it's not preoccupied with getting rid of or becoming. It's just in that witnessing mode, noticing the way things are, noticing cause and effect. And it seems to me that the natural occurrence is insight. And that to me is mental health. Mental health is the ability to know how things work. Right? So it's not such a big deal, and it is a big deal. You know, it's without that, you'd only have techniques, and you'd be kind of just surviving, sort of, sometimes happy, sometimes unhappy. So insight is based upon Four Noble Truths, Three Characteristics, these kinds of ways. But basically, it's establishing that ability to witness to the way things are. So things like choiceless awareness become very interesting, where one isn't always in a mode of training or controlling or trying to do something about the way things are, but witnessing to that. And getting to that, say the difference between what I said this morning, the difference between receiving this moment and trying to get an insight into this moment. That's the danger with insight, you're trying to get that insight somehow. So there's a grasping of the moment with an agenda in the background. Whereas when you're more receptive and allowing things to happen, then you just notice things. It's just the way, I think that's just the way the healthy mind works. So in the choiceless awareness practices, you're training in just letting things be. It doesn't have to be a training, but that just learning just to allow the flow of life to come and go. This is Good Friday. I don't understand Christianity. But the best take I've enjoyed on the Christian teachings are the perennial philosophers. And I don't know if you've read about their take on it, but what they talk about is they find through all religious traditions, the heart of each religious tradition is presence. So in their take on Christianity, when Jesus says, "I am the life, the truth, and the way," that Jesus isn't pointing himself as an individual, but he says, "I am that." And the life, the truth, and the way is awareness, or presence. The Advaita Vedanta teachers, Nisargadatta's book, "I am that," this pure being, pure knowing, pure presence. If you read Karen Armstrong's book on the history of God, some of the Judaic takes on God and the Christian takes on God and the Islamic takes on God is that it's not dual. Unfortunately, there was one saint who said, "I am God," and got killed. So sometimes you have to be careful. It's not politically correct. But what it does, it's not this kind of dualistic thing of me and some being, but some sense of divinity in the present moment, and I am that. So I am awareness. But Buddhism doesn't use the I, it just says there is knowing. So Ajahn Sumedho's line would be, the past is a memory, the future is unknown, now is the knowing. Soto Zen, they say about just sitting, chicken taza, just being, is enlightenment, something like that, I don't want to misquote. But the Sufi, these God-intoxicated beings, are just delightful, aren't they? But if you really read that in the view of not in a dualistic view, but you read that in a sense of like presence, then you see what they're talking about. If you look at a dualistic, you think, gosh, they're just stoned all the time. But you have to go beyond, you understand the imagery. If you look at that lovely poem from T.S. Eliot, "Man's curiosity searches past and future and clings to that dimension, but to apprehend the intersection of the timeless with time is the occupation of a saint. No occupation either, but a life lived in love, ardor, selflessness, and self-surrender." You know, the intersection of the timeless with time, pure presence. In the Prajnaparamita Sutta, you have pure presence is ever transcending. So you get this, if you don't take the dualistic approaches of religions, which tends to be what fundamentalism kind of takes, but you look at different ways, then you do find a common ground. Of course, they might not agree with me. So I stick with Buddhism. But in any kind of interreligious dialogue, you do have to ask, what are the terms of reference rather than the assumptions? If someone says to you, do you believe in God? Don't answer no. Say, what do you mean by God? And then you can answer yes or no. And that's what the Dalai Lama, he did a workshop in Cockforth Abbey, north of south of London, around London, with the Cistercian monks, and they asked him to comment on the Gospels, and he actually studied a bit beforehand, and then they'd read out some aspect of the Gospel, and they'd ask him to comment on it. And one of the things they asked him, if Christ was here today, what would you ask him? First thing he said, what's the nature of the Father? Because that's the kind of definitive thing. If whatever a Christian person says is ultimate truth is outside, then that dualism wouldn't fit Buddhism. But if whatever that is pointing to is something in consciousness, then we have a way of kind of getting the same language. So. And there was one interesting one with the Italian monk that was with me in New Zealand the first 4 years, and his mother's a Jehovah's Witness. She's appalled at him he's doomed to hell and all that. And so he was telling me, they were talking, she says, and he says, okay, what's Yahweh? Jehovah's Witness, right? Yahweh. Well, and the language she was the same as our language for Nibbana. Uncreated, unoriginated, unformed, unnameable. Oh, you witness to that? Oh, so do I. And then she got confused. And she had to kind of close it down. Because she didn't have a mind which could doubt. She didn't have a reflective mind, she had a position mind. And she had to kind of close off her mind to her own son. Because of a position. You can close off the love you have to your child because of some philosophical position. It's pretty bizarre to me. So he really threw her for a loop. Because in her tradition, doubt is the devil. So you got this son, and hey, wait a minute, I'm doubting now. Really got her in confusion. Yet he was just trying to lead her to what he thought Yahweh might be, the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed. So that kind of dialogue is very difficult. You have to have two parties who are willing to listen, rather than two books who want to fight. then there's no real dialogue. Then you just have to back off and say, may you be happy. That's about all you can do. But the simple, like pure presence is ever transcending. I've used that a lot. Pure presence is ever transcending. It doesn't mean that I don't feel the painful me or the lonely emotion or whatever, but presence can allow that to arise and cease in consciousness, because presence is always bigger. It's always bigger than that movement. The movement moves through presence. And you cannot find presence. You can only be present, right? You can't find it as an object, because it's not an object. It's a mystery. It's the mystery of our existence, isn't it? And so if you look at how the Buddha's teaching is working, it says craving for objects takes you away from presence. Yeah. So when I'm preoccupied with some devious plan I have for whatever I want to do, then that very preoccupation, right, is a kind of forgetting that behind it all there's this pure presence, awareness, knowing, whatever you want to call it. And so it's returning to that, awakening to that, remembering to that, rather than getting rid of one thing so I can have another thing. So the whole pain-pleasure principle of sense experience is where the delusion arises. We want to maximize pleasure and minimize pain. And the thing is, it does work sometimes. That's the problem. It does. You can move and get out of the pain. And you can drink a glass of a cup of tea rather than a cup of coffee. There are limits to that. But the deathless is not based on pain and pleasure. It's based on knowing pain and pleasure. So without kind of, sometimes people think you just have to go into self-mortification, you know, I'm not supposed to enjoy pleasure. But that's not to be another position. I shouldn't be happy because I want to be enlightened. But then you take another position. So it's not taking positions. It's just knowing, oh, this is the way it feels now. It's just, it's very, very, very simple. Where it gets complex then is in the delusion, like I was talking about the amount of work I've had to do with fear, where even though my teachers could say just to let fear through your mind, my desire to get rid of the fear was so deeply embedded in me, I couldn't see it. I just had hit my head against the wall a few million times before I could see that. And that's the nature of delusion. We can use all the language, let go, don't make it a problem, but the clinging, the attachment and all that, it can be very, kind of very deeply rooted. So these kinds of retreats are sort of a chance to take away the distractions and just see, you know, how can I just be at peace with the way things are, be it good, bad, or indifferent, whatever it is. So in your, maybe just keep that in mind, that at times if things are internally quite difficult, you really don't need to meditate per se on an object. You need to allow this material to come up, because you're not intending to do that. You're not intending to feel miserable or feel frightened or whatever. This is now coming up into consciousness. And then the language of faith. You know, like, do you have a language of faith? The faith might just be this will change. That might be sufficient. Or hang in there, or it'll be right, or looking at a Buddha image, or whatever helps you to keep objective to the movement through consciousness. And then do train. Do develop skillful tools that help you stabilize the mind. And through it all, insight, the witnessing of the way things are. All right, shall we sit a bit?